This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay, so our topic, I want to say up front, it's an extremely sensitive topic. And I'm saying that because many of us have family members who are converts. Many of us have community members who are converts. But I would say on a more difficult plane, many of us are aware that many people out there convert with a particular movement or rabbis and discover that that conversion is not honored or recognized by other movements or rabbis. And we're not going to solve that today. Everyone's not going to start packing up and hang out for room five. But I think it's particularly important that we get educated, at least in terms of what the issues are, as a way of thinking about how we arrived at this situation and where the points of tension are. Now, this study could work. You know, the issue of conversion is an issue for Jewish populations anywhere there are Jews today. But in the state of Israel, it's become even more complex because as a Jewish state, we guarantee citizenship to Jews, which of course then raises the question, as you now know what's coming, well, who is a Jew that qualifies for citizenship? And the whole issue of sort of citizenship and national identity and conversion as a religious process has become a very difficult, tangled knot in the modern state of Israel. It's created a lot of tension, a lot of difficulty. And my only goal here today, I'll say up front, I'm not here to take sides, but I would like all of us to come out of this discussion with a clear understanding, at least, of what the core issues are. So when people throw out terms like, well, we don't recognize your Beit Din, or you don't follow mitzvot, or you can't do that, or you don't have the authority, we'll at least have a better sense of what we're actually fighting about. So, without any further ado, we're going to take a look at the first source together, and then I'm going to have you in Chavruta look at source number two, and I'll give you specific instructions in a moment. But let's look at the first source, and of course, then you'll understand how this topic got folded in to what looks to be a very promising, uplifting discussion of these wonderful women biblical figures, how we ended up into conversion and fighting, which we're talented at as a Jewish people. But Ruth, of course, is perceived as the first convert, which is interesting. Not all authorities agreed. Maimonides, in fact, thinks the entire Jewish people at Mount Sinai were converted. But at least classically, Ruth is sort of labeled as the model, as the first convert. And what's important here when you look at the line, and I'm sure you've already studied this passage, that's already been covered. Anybody? Yes? Ruth? Good. When Ruth is exclaiming her willingness to follow along with Naomi, she says, right, don't ask me to leave you. And then she has the famous statement, which is so important, Amech ami velokayich elokai. Your people will be my people and your God will be my God. The reason that's important, aside from the drama of the story, is that whether this verse set up a certain paradigm or we've had that paradigm from the very beginning, but we understand here that conversion along the Jewish model is not only a religious conversion. That is to say, it's not only your God will be my God in the sense that I will now worship God, the God, with a capital the, in the Jewish way. But in addition, your people will be my people, right? There is, miraculously, a transformation of ethnicity that happens with conversion. Which means that in the Jewish conception of things, and I think it's fair to say, certainly you'll see in a minute in the rabbinic conception of things, conversion cannot be reduced to either some kind of national change or a religious change, but it's always understood as the convergence of both. Meaning, and this is really important for our purposes here, when a non-Jew becomes a Jew, The assumption from the text is that there is a dual transformation taking place. There is a transformation on what we would call a religious, maybe even spiritual plane, where a person is now undertaking or committing themselves to serve God, worship God, according to the dictates of Judaism. But there is also a national ethnic shift. They are joining a people, right? They are becoming part of a particular ethnic group. And we understand that to make sense. We're very used to that because we're used to the idea of the covenant of Abraham being this ethnic covenant of land and seed, and the covenant of Sinai being about accepting the Torah and becoming a nation of priests, whatever that might mean. We're very used to the idea that these things go hand in hand. It's very unique, right? Christianity and Islam, there are multiple ethnicities and nationalities included there. But we as Jews were very used to that combination of ethnic and religious identity. But I just want to point out to you, the conversion process also reflects that. And what's going to get tricky is, I don't know who ordered modernity. Okay? It's really become quite inconvenient. There's some pluses. The healthcare is better, and much better entertainment. But the complexity of identity in the modern world, where religious identity for Jews and ethnic identity have been at least theoretically split off, is going to be a source of a lot of our tension in trying to figure this out. So, any questions about what I said so far? Anybody want to disagree violently? You know, not in a literal sense, of course. No? Okay. What I'd like you to do now, this next source that you have in front of you is a fascinating source in that this is one of the only places in the Talmud where the conversion process is discussed. There's no tractate Gerim. There's no tractate devoted to conversion. There is no section in the Mishnah. The Mishnah will mention converts, but interestingly enough, the rabbis do not lay out in a systematic way what conversion means. This source is the text. You are now going to be experts in the Tannaitic model of conversion by doing this very long and interesting Braita, a Tannaitic source that's not included in the Mishnah. And what I'd like you to do is to take some time, look at this source, and then, as true rabbinic scholars and halachic decision makers, come up with your list of what does the conversion process look like. If you were going to write a little paragraph handbook, here is what it means to convert, and here is what's required. Okay? Sounds simple enough? All right. And I will move around and help you if I can. Are we ready? Yes? Let's do it. Source number two. Okay, everybody. Did you have a chance to see the text? Okay. Could you repeat what you said to me when I was going by? Nice and loud.
I said, what has happened to us that we have reversed the process?
Because this looks what?
This looks easy.
Yeah. How many people had a reaction that this looks kind of easy? Okay. I mean, easy might be we're in a comparison mode, but I hear what you're saying, right? This isn't volumes and volumes. So let's talk about what's here. So first of all, what do you get from this text? Do we seek out converts according to this text? It looks like not, all right? Because the case that they give, of course, is that somebody comes to us, which I'm willing to acknowledge seems to suggest that we're not out there in the airports handing out literature. That doesn't happen anymore, I guess. I dated myself with that example, right? The airport? You can't do that anymore. Okay. Right. For those who remember, that used to happen at airports. So it does. It looks like that we're not out there soliciting it, but are we close to the idea? No, we don't seem close. There's no statement that says, you know what, this is a messy business, better to stay out of it. There is no indication of that in the text. There is an indication, however, what about the intentionality of the convert? Yes?
Well, accept the commandments.
Okay, we're going to come to that. I'm going to make a note of that. That's going to be extremely important for us. And here's where my terrible handwriting is going to get me into trouble. Oh, it's coming out a little bit better than normal. Accepting mitzvot. Some of you may actually be able to read that, which is very exciting for me. Okay, accepting mitzvot. We can see that?
Yeah.
Even this side of the room?
Go back a few more inches.
Go back a few more inches? Yeah, all right. We're going to come back to that. Yes?
But the interesting thing is at the beginning, it's more of the ethnic thing that you're talking about. Recognizing you become part of this people, and then it first talks about the mitzvot that has to do with the
Ah, we'll talk about which mitzvot in a moment. But the ethnic piece is very clear, right? They're told, listen, just so you know, this isn't just about being able to have chant or kiddush and shul. We, the Jewish people, we're not doing great these days. And this is, of course, we're living under Roman occupation at the time. And we're saying, just so you know, this is not the the easiest group to join right now. And when you join, you know, they say membership has its privileges or some ad like that. Mm-hmm. Membership is also going to have its responsibilities and associations. You're going to be part of that. What else do we have?
The first thing is, why do you want to do it?
Okay, so intention is important, all right? And what is the and what is the required intention?
Well, why does he say, I am unworthy?
Well, that's a great question. Why is that the answer? Why does that answer encourage us, do you think?
Because one should be modest.
Okay.
I am unworthy, I still want to accept.
Right, we're looking for the person who's not sort of reluctantly agreeing, yeah, I'll join your funny little people and its strange customs because, you know, the pickles are excellent. We're looking for the person who feels, wow, this is an opportunity, right? The intention, I think, is important here. And I think this idea of humility and a sense of joining something important is definitely present. Yes. Correct. Beautiful. I know things are hard for being a Jew. It's still, for me, a step up. Right? Yes?
One, I think that it's not for practical gain. But the other question I have is...
Hold on. Let's get... That's important. The intention is can't be, I'm going to benefit out of it. And by the way, we're not going to address it right now. The whole question of the intention to convert to get married... This created a lot of discussion in the halakhic world because of this issue. Is that a valid intention? Is that an invalid intention? What about couples today that can get married even without converting? Does that change it? Complicated issue. We'll do it next summer. Yeah.
You mentioned we're under Roman rule, but this is Babylonian Talmud.
It is in the Babylonian Talmud, but it's a Brita. It's a Tanaitic source, so we can date it to around 200 CE in the land of Israel. It's found in the Babylonian Talmud, but it's a source from that time. Somebody who hasn't spoken, I'll come to you in 1 second. Yes, sir.
Just on the accepting mitzvot, a simple reading doesn't show that there needs to be acceptance. You just have to understand that there are ramifications.
That's a great question. That's a great question or a great point. And some of it depends a little bit about how you understand the last phrase there, if he accepts, he is circumcised immediately. That's going to be a really important point of discussion. What I hear, I'm going to reframe your question so it says what I wanted you to say, because it's more convenient for me. I'm very needy and selfish that way. But you'll tell me if I'm getting this wrong. What does this mean, really? Does this mean I'm accepting them to do them? Does this mean I'm acknowledging that this is part of it, even though... Fair enough. We're going to come to that. And it really raises, I think, the key question that we're going to come to of how observant or loyal is this person expected to be? And that's going to be a really core question for us. But there does seem to be an assumption, I'm happy to be corrected if you don't think so, that this person is going to take on a Jewish life. Meaning... I don't think there's an assumption here that says, well, he wants to be Jewish, but he's going to form his own synagogue and do it his own way. There's very much an idea, you're informing him, I think, of communal norms. This is how we do things. This is what happens when we fail to do those things. This is our system. How much knowledge do you think he has to have before he or she finishes? Yeah.
Not a lot.
But it refers to some minor and some major. So it's not exhaustive.
Okay.
So it's a limited knowledge.
So first of all, doesn't have to pass the chief rabbi exam, right? That's number one. And it doesn't seem like we're talking about years and years of intensive study. The timeline here, I'll grant you, is not clear. But I personally don't get the impression of, you know, well, once you've made your way around all the bookcases here and read all those books, come back to me and we'll see what you think. I think this idea of you inform him, my understanding is you inform him of the basics. This is Shabbat. This is Kashrut. You're not going to expect they know how to tie tzitzis or write tefillin. It doesn't seem like you're going to expect that. However, it's legitimate to assume that they're committing themselves to doing it the way everybody else does it. Anything else that we need to take note of? Yeah?
Where's the female convert in any of this?
Where is the female convert in any of this? She's in there. There are rabbinic discussions, and obviously she has the same process except for circumcision. But there's an assumption that women can convert as well. You're right that the male pronoun here is used. And, well, bris, right. Now, but that's something that nobody mentioned, which I think right? What are the foundational actions? In addition to accepting commandments, which is sort of vague, what do we assume everybody has to do? Okay, so circumcision for men and mikvah, the ritual bath. Yes? Ah.
And gleaning and all that.
Beautiful.
Showing that the basic lifestyle was agricultural at that time.
That's certainly true, but there's also an important point which I want to come back to. When you look at which commandments are emphasized, we're going to come back to your point in 1 second. Valerie, your hand was up.
I was just going back a little bit. I wanted to know, why weren't they encouraging people to do that?
It's a great question. The question was, why weren't they encouraging people to convert? First of all, some people think in the Second Temple period people were encouraged. That's number one. And there was a fair amount of conversion going on. In the Second Temple period, in the wider world, Christianity certainly aggressively converted people, and there's overlap during this period. The interpretation that emerged, of course, is the idea that Gentiles, as it's said in this text, don't have to convert in order to merit the world to come, right? Their spiritual perfection and afterlife is not dependent upon becoming Jewish. But it's been a live issue even today where some rabbis have said, you know, today maybe we should be out there encouraging it, but there seems to be a long bias against it, I think primarily because for 1,000 years living in Christian and Muslim rule, it was absolutely prohibited. If a Muslim converted to Judaism, they quickly had to move to a Christian country and the other way around. Otherwise, it's heresy. So a lot of conversion issues were really dormant, truth be told, for a very long time as Jews were living under these two other sort of dominant religions. I want to come back to your point because it's interesting that the mitzvot that are detailed here are not kashrut and tefillin and tzitzit and things like that, but a lot of it has to do with moral and ethical, right? Taking care of the poor, which I think is very striking and very interesting. But let's, yes?
Well, that was what I wanted to say, that right in the beginning they're saying there's a price to be in
Jews. Yes. Absolutely. They're economic and this idea of social responsibility. You're not just joining to be close to God. If you're joining, you are now taking on responsibility for all your fellow Jews and becoming part of them.
And also, I think it's interesting just even before that, that in Ruth, when she says she wants to go with her, the first thing she says, she doesn't say your God will be my God.
Ah, people first.
People.
Beautiful. Yep. And that seems to be reflected here in terms of when I mean mitzvot, first comes social responsibility. Excellent, excellent point. So wait, why circumcision and why mikvah? Any thoughts?
Well,
Yeah. In defining you, really, according to the covenant, right? The circumcision is the covenant of Abraham, basic ethnic covenant. Yes, you're entering Lachnis Lebrich Avram Avinu. You're becoming, that's how males are sort of, it's the sign of that covenantal bond to the people. And mikvah is often seen as a type of like rebirth, emerging from the water, impurity to purity. And it has that image of the convert sort of taking on a new identity. I think it's legitimate to say that my conclusion from this is that conversion is certainly a transformational moment. We are asking the convert, or demanding that the convert take on the responsibilities and obligation of Jewish life. The amount that they have to know or don't know, in my opinion, is left very vague here. It's not, we don't get a curriculum laid out as to what's expected that they should know. And the time frame, I would argue, does not seem to be months and months and months, and certainly not years and years and years. I'm assuming some of that is a surprise based on what you see around you in terms of how long it takes somebody to convert. Okay, we'll come back to that. The other component that's going to be critical for us that did not get mentioned in this text comes up in a text very close by. Take a look at source number 3. Rabbi Chia bar Abba stated in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Ger Tzarich Shlosha. Conversion requires 3. What 3 is he referring to? He's referring to Beit Din. Why is this one going to be so complicated? What's the big problem? Beit Din just means a court of 3, implying that the convert cannot convert by his or herself, himself, herself, and can't just do it in front of witnesses, but there is some kind of court that's present.
Is there a majority needed among the 3? Is that why they have 3?
Well, it's very interesting. I don't have a sense it's like a legal case where they have to vote on it. I think it's more like they've already decided they're going to accept this person. And therefore, the court of 3 sort of represents the it represents the people. It's like a formal entranceway that's lent a certain power and force. Oh, that's the killer, isn't it? Which Beit Din? Who gets to be on the Beit Din? Now, are your denominational nerves tingling yet? Are you now feeling it? Hey, who can be on that Beit Din? Which rabbi? Which women, which men, how observant, which movement? Does their last name rhyme with Nookstein, as an example, that emerged? Do you see how I kept it on the down low? No one knew what I was referring to. I kept it very quiet, right? So we already know. I think we can sense going forward, right? If we had to identify where the main challenges are going to come, okay, is this one up here, accepting mitzvot, and who's on the Beit Din and who controls that. Now, the biggest can of worms you could imagine. Now, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, this still does not look complicated. By the way, the Shulchan Aruch Hilchot Geirim is one section with about 12 little subsections. You could read through the whole thing in about 15 minutes. And this is what he says. He sums up what we assume he would say from the Talmud. All aspects of the conversion process, informing the candidate of the commandments so he or she may accept them, circumcision and immersion, should be done before 3 who are fit to judge and during the day. Okay? Meaning there are certain basic elements, circumcision, immersion, informing of the commandments, basically what all of you had down here. And the court is responsible for that, and we can even say the court is what's going to determine the issue of intent. That's the job of the court. The job of the court, presumably, is to make sure the person coming through this process has appropriate intent. Yeah. Correct.
Whatever they're saying.
Correct.
And the jump to the Beit Din, which is not in the original text.
Correct.
Is now a question of validation. You're now
well,
stepping
right.
outside of it.
It all depends. What is original text? You're right. This was an Amoraic addition to a Tannaitic text. They weren't adding on. They were just reading it in. You're right.
So I'm saying, but that jump is such a substantive jump. Obviously, from witness to Beit Din, it's not just about who appoints it. It's really, you're now taking it away from the person saying it himself. You're now questioning intent in a way that doesn't, that you don't.
Look, it's an excellent question, because the issue is, in the opening text, who's the Omrimlo, right? That's the hidden question that you're really raising. Who's speaking to this person, and who's going to take them in? In my reading, there was always the equivalent of a Beit Din. There's some group that's in charge of taking them in, and the Amoraic edition simply formalized it. But it's a very fair point. I don't really know. But there does seem to be, like, the convert approaches some body.
Yeah, but if they're Edim, they're witnesses, they're just validating it occurred.
Well, the Edim, I think, come in later in the story. But there's some group at the start of the story that's doing the educating and the talking and the checking. And then there are witnesses that confirm that all those things took place. But your point is still well taken. So, in the Shulchan Aruch, again, this doesn't look overly complicated or overly challenging. The problem, of course, is fundamentally that there is not agreement in the Jewish world about what either of these things should mean or connote, both theologically and sociologically. To put it in a slightly different term, the job of the conversion court is basically to ensure that the convert joining is going to live a Jewish life that they sort of see as the required norm. For better or for worse, right? Not saying perfection. I'm not saying everything. I don't think that the conversion court meant to assume the person has become a leading rabbinic scholar. But you see where that's headed, right? The assumption is, we inform him of those things that we do. Those of us on the Beit Din were the rabbinic leadership of our group. Well, what happens when Jews no longer agree in the most fundamental, basic way about what is normative and what is expected of Jews to do or to be? This is a really important point. See, we all duck this in a very, not all of us, I shouldn't speak for everybody in the room. The Jewish people as a whole, we get a pass on this one because our notion of ethnic peoplehood includes everyone, whether they eat bacon on Yom Kippur or not. Right? We have the benefit of this clause that says, by being born into the Jewish people, you're always a member. Doesn't matter about your religious behavior. You're always a member. Now, that wasn't universally. There were some questions about that, particularly if you converted out to another religion. But let's assume fundamentally that the rabbinic aphorism, an Israelite, even though he has sinned, is still an Israelite, took all this pressure off. Not across the board. We'll see where it gets applied in certain cases. But in terms of fundamental identity, a completely non-observant Jew is still fully Jewish. But now we're on a different model. The person's trying to join. They don't have the benefits of being born into membership. And now suddenly we're being confronted with the question of, okay, so a convert does not have the benefit of being able to be a non-observant Jew, at least from the rabbinic text. Right? There's no real mechanism for that. Now, to be fair, I'm assuming it's because back in the Talmudic times, there were really no such thing. I'm sure you had Jews who observed more and Jews who observed less, but the idea of being Jewish being a combined religious ethnic identity was sort of understood. They didn't go to synagogue expecting to find a lot of people who were there, but said, oh, I'd never heard of the Sabbath, I'm not interested. It was part of a fabric of life. But in the modern period, it becomes much more complicated. When you have secular Jews and nationalist Jews, and you have Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox Jews, and suddenly what our opening text could assume, well, you inform the convert of the basic way we do things. We have Shabbat, we have Kashrut, and we pray, and we say Shema, and here are the things that we do. Well, who's the we now? Who's the we that gets to decide what's normative and what's expected? So now in the modern period, we have a very significant problem. Now, what happens with Beit Din? I'll give you the source for the technical problem, and then we'll talk about the hidden political and sociological problem. Yeah. Look, we don't have a sense in the Middle Ages that there was any kind of like massive liberalization of Jewish life. So whenever you see that happening, right, from the Hamburg Temple in 1760 or 1770 on forward is, I think, when you start to see major disagreements in the sense of what normative Jewish life should look like. You know, before that time in the Middle Ages, by and large, a Jew could travel from Yemen all the way to Siberia, hopping from Jewish community to Jewish community on the way, and find fundamentally the cuisine and style of dress and local language would be different, but the basic bookcase, the calendar, the basic siddur, Shabbat, holidays, right? He's going to show up in Siberia on Rosh Hashanah and he's still going to hear the shofar. He's still going to recognize the entire Musaf service, right? He's still going to recognize the chalot or the two bread. You know what I'm saying? That all changes dramatically as we enter the modern period. That commonality falls. So let's take a look at what the issue is with the Beit Din. The Shulchan Aruch brings down a couple of rules. Let's take a look at source 5. All those who are invalid to serve as a witness because of a family connection or sin are also prohibited from serving as a judge. Okay? If you can't be a witness in a Jewish court, you also can't sit on the Beit Din. Now comes the problem. So first of all, we already know who's going to get eliminated?
Women.
All right. Boy, we weren't short on that one. Already women. Relatives also, people aren't usually as bothered by that one, but you are 100% right. You can't have a relative of yours sit on your Beit Din, but women is already a very big challenge. This other piece of being a sinner, and I use that term within the legal text, not from a judgmental perspective. A sinner is an invalid witness, according to the Shulchan Aruch. Who is a sinner or a rasha? Anyone who violates a prohibition for which one is liable for lashes, right? All the more so if one violates a prohibition that is liable for the death penalty. It makes no difference if he violates these prohibitions out of desire or anger. Well, now we have a serious problem. Because what are we going to say now? There are movements in Judaism that no longer self-define as halachic, right? Which means they don't view driving on Shabbat as a sin. They view it as normal, okay? But what's going to happen when you have rabbis on a Beit Din who might happen to be women? Apparently that can happen, I'm told, okay? Women, or they don't keep Shabbat in the traditional way, or they don't even keep kosher. Not out of a sense of rebellion, but because the movement of Judaism with which they participate does not see these actions as being required anymore. Without getting into, it doesn't matter the right and the wrong, and this is a sin, and you're not progressive, and you're, we can go into those accusations and counter-accusations all we want. But I'm trying to give you a lens now from the Orthodox rabbinic perspective. These courts that are converting people are not legitimate rabbinic courts because the judges on these courts do not meet the criteria, the traditional halachic criteria of who can sit on a court. Are we all clear about the problem? And it's very hard to solve. Yeah. I don't think it's even a matter of who's going to say. I don't think it's something that's hidden. I think that, you know, if you're within a liberal Jewish movement that's not halachic, I don't think it's like, has anybody ever seen them drive on Shabbat? I think they publicly drive on Shabbat because they don't see it as a violation of Shabbat. That's the problem. Within the traditional halachic frame, these are sins. Within a modern Jewish lens, these are denominational differences between different approaches to what Judaism is and what Judaism should be about. Yes?
So how do you explain the problem within the Orthodox community where people are Shabbos observant, are kosher, and those that they do are also negated?
What a great question. We'll come to that in one second. I don't have an explanation. I could offer a theory, but I don't have a halachic explanation at all. But we'll talk about it in a minute. Yes? So really, you're kind of asking similar questions, because what you're noticing, the question was, what about the territoriality of it? Meaning, what you're now noticing here is an intersection between halachic criteria and sort of authority and legitimacy. Because I have heard people on the Orthodox side say, well, you know what? Liberal rabbis should just get out of the conversion business. That'll solve the problem. If they stop converting people and just leave it up to the Orthodox, then there'll be agreement. What they're not understanding, I don't think, is that liberal Jewish movements are not converting people as a protest to Orthodoxy. They're converting people because the job of the converting body is to ask the convert to adopt and accept the form of Judaism that they themselves are educating towards. You can't ask a Reform Beit Din to have Orthodox standards for its converts. That doesn't line up. That's just fundamentally not going to happen, right? In other words, the solution here is not going to be in somehow forcing an Orthodox standard, because as we already saw, the job of the converting body is to make sure that the candidate for conversion reflects their vision of what being a Jew is supposed to be. So liberal Jews, by definition, can't be asked to create Orthodox Jews. They can only be asked to create Jews, if you pardon that expression, that reflect their vision of what Jews and Judaism ought to be. Meaning, I'm being very lengthy and long-winded about this. The debate about conversion, it's not about conversion per se. Conversion is a symptom over the fundamental debate about what it means to be a Jew and what Judaism is supposed to look like. And that is a much trickier problem. Now, to add on to that, which a couple of you mentioned, there's also this whole question of the authority. Who gets to be the Beit Din? Who's in charge? Who holds the whatever you call that arm that lets you into the parking lot, right? Who's the one that decides which cars come in? The gatekeeper, thank you. Who gets to come in, who doesn't come in? That is also part of what's happening here. There's that contains within it a tremendous amount of authority and control and power. And we can understand why, then, there'd be a lot of turf wars over that particular issue.
Oh, that's not exactly what I meant by territoriality. In England, we've had a number of cases when children have been permitted to go attend a Jewish school because their mother was converted in Israel.
Right.
And so it was said, yeah, that conversion is fine in Israel, by Orthodox authority, but not acceptable in England.
So that, what turns out there is every local Beit Din now, I'm sorry, the question of what do you do where you have, if I understand the question, you'll have a school in England that will say, oh, you converted with the Rabbanut in Israel, your mother did, your kid can come to my school. But when that kid wants to go get married with a London Beit Din will say, that's the Rabbanut, we don't recognize their conversions, right? Because on a certain level, right, oh, the kid won't be accepted. Because every Beit Din now not only reserves the right who they convert and who they don't convert, but now they also reserve the right to say whose conversions they recognize and whose they don't. Now, the issue, since it came up, right, I see we're really cheering people up here, Mayor. It's really an uplifting, positive, great topic on my part. Yes. So, I just want to take a look at Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote about non-Orthodox conversions to give you a sense of what's going on here. Pertaining to the matter of converts converted by conservative rabbis. He even mentioned reform, by the way. In any event, we require the acceptance of the commandments before a Beit Din. And one can assume that conservative rabbis do not fulfill this function. First, and I apologize to all conservative Jews in the room, but it's an important text. First, they are not fully learned in the laws of conversion, and even if they are not careful in fulfilling these requirements. Therefore, the declaration of commitment to fulfill the commandments is insufficient, and no conversion has taken place. Second, conservative rabbis are unfit to serve on a Beit Din because they deny many principles of faith and are lax in their own observance of the commandments. Even if we have no specific testimony, I think Valerie, you raised this, Rav Moshe thought of your question, Valerie, regarding the religious observance of a particular rabbi, we have a legal assumption that if he uses the title of conservative rabbi, then he is lax in his observance and doesn't accept all the principles of faith. Wow. Doesn't that make you feel warm and cuddly all over? But look, I want to turn this around for a minute. He, of course, as an Orthodox posek, is framing this in a pejorative. I don't think you have to view it that way. I think you could say what he calls lax, we can use the word different, right? What he calls progressive, what we call denial of principles of faith, somebody else might use the term updating. In other words, even if we peel back the negative critical language here, what he's pointing at, I don't think is inaccurate in the sense that there are basic differences, fault lines in denominational Judaism today. Jews believe differently and practice differently. And therefore, we should not be surprised when those differences in belief and practice yield a lack of recognition of the authority to perform conversion if we assume the authority to perform these conversions is rooted in the authority of a Beit Din, which represents the standards and norms that community is meant to uphold. Yeah.
For those of us that aren't up to date on this, can you just give us an idea of the background of when he wrote this?
Rav Moshe Feinstein, I believe, wrote this in the 1970s. A question, Rabbi Feinstein, I have somebody who converted with a conservative Beit Din. What's their status? Can I count them in a minyan? Can they have an aliyah to the Torah? Can they join my synagogue? Can I marry their kids?
And was this written for the United States?
Yes, it's written in the United States. But before we, you know, the Orthodox rabbinates across the globe do not accept the validity of non-Orthodox conversions.
Or another one where he basically invalidated a the actions of a conservative rabbi, I think in the case of marriage.
Yeah, that's he did that. That actually
to avoid
a problem of Mamzei Brut. Yes, true. Different topic, but important. Yeah. Where do you go? That's a good question. It's a very tough question because basically now the proliferation of movements and Batei Din, you're in a situation where you could probably legitimately wonder, wait, if I convert here, who thinks I'm Jewish and who doesn't think I'm Jewish? That's a tough question. There was a hand up in the back. Just to spare... Hold on, I have to follow. You're uncomfortable that you don't have more of a problem.
Because it makes sense to me that if there's a club and Judaism is a club, it makes sense that those in charge of the club would define the rules. The problem is that they're a club.
Absolutely.
At the time they weren't a club.
That's all I'm saying, right? That's all I'm really saying is it makes sense that if you see yourself as the gatekeeper, you want to insist that the people joining reflect the Judaism that you are part of and participate in. And all of that would be well and good if we didn't have this pesky problem of trying to preserve one Jewish people and the fact that there's only one Jewish state. And in other words, if we were all left to play quietly, you know, I use this analogy, and I think it'll speak to some of you. If you go into a two-year-old nursery, you will notice all the kids sort of, they're all playing, but they're playing by themselves next to each other. We call that parallel play, for those who want to know. I haven't progressed out of that stage, but just so we're all clear. But if you go to a 3 or 4 year old gone, you'll notice they're not playing next to each other. Some of the kids are actually playing with each other, which on the one hand is powerful because they're socializing and connecting, but it also leads to fighting. Because when Josh and I are parallel play, so he plays with his blocks and I play with my crayons and all is good and I don't have to like the way he stacks them. He doesn't have to like the way I color them. We get along. But the minute Josh, who's more advanced than I am on emotional and intellectual level, says, hey, let's color the blocks together and do something fun together. Well, now we're going to, well, which blocks do we color and what colors do we use? You see where that's going. So in other words, Rav Moshe Feinstein's response, taken in isolation for an Orthodox community, we might say, okay, we can live with that. The problem is if we still are operating under this desire to have one Jewish people and one Jewish state, you now see where these problems are going to come in. Because, and I'll go off script for a moment. What does it mean to say we're one Jewish state and tell the 10 million liberal Jews in the world that their converts aren't converts? That's a tough. What's that message? Yeah. Because let's ask the question: do we imagine if, in the Talmud, whoever that group is that's welcoming people in, if the candidate had said, "I have no intention of keeping the Sabbath the way you people do, or dietary laws the way you do, and I'm not going to come to synagogue very often," do we think they still take him?
No.
In other words, it's open in the sense that we don't make him memorize the entire rule book on day one. But how about if we come in assuming or suspecting they don't intend to follow the rules?
But why can't it be the conservative Beit Din, the reform Beit Din, everybody else's Beit Din, and they have their rules, and you get converted according to their rules?
That's what happens now. The problem is, from the Orthodox perspective, and you know everyone down the line looking to their left, that Beit Din's not a Beit Din. They don't qualify, and the convert has not signed on to the vision of Judaism that we think is normative. Now, this question of Kabbalat Mitzvot, right? Accepting the commandments. There's a lot. The question is, how open? I think this came up. This is really what you were pointing at in terms of how much do I have to really do? That's actually a very important contemporary debate. Because the Rabbanut is already understood for decades that there is a very significant problem here. On the one hand, if we close the door too tightly, we run the risk of having an increasing number of Israeli citizens who are culturally and let's even say ethnically Jewish, but are not halachically Jewish. Right now, the number is 80,000 and rising. However, the flip side is, what about the standards and norms of halacha? So you find there is a very basic debate on this issue of Kabbalat mitzvot, which will then impact what we're going to say to the following scenario. Why can't the Rabbanut or any Orthodox Beit Din accept any convert even though they know they're not going to be observant if they truly desire to join the Jewish people? You know what? Let's take a few minutes. I'd like you to take a look at sources 8 and 9 on your own with your chavruta just for 10 minutes or so, and then we'll come back to it and we'll see what you think. All right. Okay, are we all encouraged and reinvigorated? So as you can see, this issue of accepting the commandments becomes a very hot button issue, right? Because let's assume we have a candidate who says, you know what? Circumcision, I can live with that. Especially in most cases, the person's already circumcised. All I have to do is hatafat dam brit, which means a little prick in that sensitive area. And mikvah, most people can handle dipping in a mikvah once in their lives. Kabbalat mitzvot, that becomes the sticking point. Because what do you do? Let's take modern Israel as an example. You have somebody who comes from the former Soviet Union whose father is Jewish and mother is not. And they see themselves as immersed in Israel and Hebrew and they serve in the army and they have no problem identifying with the Jewish people. But Jewish ritual laws, they don't come from religious background. Prayer, kashrut, Shabbat, these are not things that have ever been part of their experience growing up. Can they see themselves observing Jewish holidays and maybe making kiddush on Friday night, lighting candles? Probably. But to take on the Shulchan Aruch, right, to take on Jewish law and live and practice life in the Orthodox fashion, they can't see it. That's too big of a jump. So how is the chief rabbinate, an Orthodox Beit Din, going to respond? What are they going to do? So what you have here are sort of two, what I would say, basic responses to how to look at that situation. One of them, Rav Uziel, was the chief Sephardic rabbi here in Israel in the 1950s and even 60s, the beginning of the 60s as well. Am I correct, Mayor? Somewhere in that time period. And take a look at what he does with Kabbalat mitzvot. And know when a Gentile comes to convert, we inform him of the basics of the religion, which is belief in one God and rejection of idolatry. We discuss this extensively with him. When it comes to accepting the commandments, we inform him of some of the lighter ones and stricter ones and inform him of the punishments of the commandments. We tell him that before he came to the stage, if he ate forbidden fat, and so now he's just quoting the Talmud. We do not overwhelm him or flood him with details of all the punishments because perhaps his intentions are for the sake of heaven. Maybe he really wants to join. Why turn him off, is what Rav Uziel is saying. It is clear from here, this is the most important sentence, that we do not demand from him that he observe the commandment, and it is not even necessary that the court knows or believes he will observe them. If not, converts would never be accepted by the Jewish people, for who can guarantee that the non-Jew will be faithful to the entire Torah? Here Rav Uziel says, what does it mean to accept the commandments? It means you think he's going to do all of them? Forget it. What does it mean then? What is he accepting? He's accepting that they exist, right? Right? First of all, he can't be a Jewish Christian. Right? He can't embrace other religions. He has to be strictly monotheistic. That we understand. Rav Uziel is saying he gets to be in the same boat with all those other Jews who don't observe Jewish law, who walk around saying, I know I shouldn't be eating this, but it's delicious. Okay? That's what he gets to be in that camp. Rav Uziel is saying accepting the commandments means acknowledging that these are the obligations of a Jew. Whether he's going to do them or not, he's going to be like all the other Jews. He'll do some, he won't do all. That's Rav Uziel. Now take a look at our friend Rav Moshe Feinstein. It is simple and obvious that a convert who has not accepted upon himself the mitzvot is not a convert, because accepting the commandments is essential. Even if he verbally accepts them, if it is known and obvious that he is not really accepting them upon himself, it is not valid. I do not understand the rabbis who err in this matter, for what benefit is there to the nation to accept these people who bring no benefit to Israel or to God? Yes, Rav Uziel Sfaradi. And he was actually responding to cases in South America where Jews, male Jews, had married non-Jewish women and wanted to raise their children as Jews. Now, huh? Yes. Oh, pre-save Israel, 30s and 40s.
This smacks of the Inquisitor with the conversion to Christians in Spain, where they went out after the conversions to see if they were really performing what they're...
Well, we can talk about that. But before we beat up on Rav Moshe Feinstein, we understand, based on what you said before, his logic. He is saying, from his perspective, the job of the Jew is to observe commandments and follow the Torah. What possible motivation do I have, Rav Moshe is saying, to create more Jews who will not follow the Torah? That is not what we're looking to do. That's an educational failure as far as he's concerned. Why would I want to propagate those failures? That's the question he's saying. He's saying from a religious perspective, from a halachic religious perspective, to create more Jews who don't observe the mitzvot is not the job of the Beit Din or of the Rabbanim. And therefore, to convert people who are not going to be fully observant, or at least intend to be fully observant, for him, that is not okay. So what is animating Rav Uziel? Rav Uziel was a pretty orthodox rabbi himself. He observed Shabbat and Kashrut and believed in all those things too. What's he thinking about?
He's thinking that there is some value in this, that there is something for the sake of heaven, while the other one thinks that there's...
What's the value? Yeah.
The point is, he's living in the state of Israel, and he's confronting the political and social problems of living in a Jewish state. When you have prospective converts who are no better, no worse than the vast majority of the population.
Well, what's amazing is he wasn't actually living that reality yet, but he was anticipating it. He understood that there is the religious dimension to this whole problem, but there's also a national dimension to this problem. There's a national dimension to this challenge. Namely, do we want a problem of intermarriage within the state of Israel? Do we want to create a situation where tens and tens of thousands of young people who are part of Israeli society and identify as members of the Jewish people can't marry other Jews, can't be buried with other Jews, and cannot participate in national religious life in this country? But in a way, these two conversations are happening like this, right? Because the religious halachic argument is saying, listen, it's about doing mitzvot and observing the Torah. How could I convert somebody to Judaism who doesn't intend to practice Judaism the way I think we're commanded to have it be practiced? And the other perspective says, it's not about that guy. or that young woman. It's about Am Yisrael living here and trying to avoid a wider social national problem. And because of that, these two groups can't communicate. The Rabbanim that want to go in Rav Uziel's direction, and the Rabbanim who right now, by the way, Rav Moshe's position and others, dominates the Rabbanut, they can't really see any common ground. Now, before we indict, the Rabbanut understands that there's a problem. I've taken many students to convert with the Rabbanut. Every student I've taken from Pardes has passed, by the way, just so we should acknowledge. And the Rabbanut understands that there's a national interest in converting people who identify and live within the Jewish community. They understand that. But at the same time, they are not willing to put aside Kabbalat mitzvot and a full intention to live an observant life. I will also tell you that the Rabbanut has fierce critics to the right who have come out to invalidate Rabbanut conversions. This comes back to your question about the rabbinate in England, for example, who say the Israeli chief rabbinate is far too lenient in its standards for conversion on precisely this issue, and have let all these people slide through the system even though they knew they would not be fully observant. So before we beat up completely on the Rabbanut, I just want to point out there are a lot of shades of gray along this whole spectrum. But the fundamental piece, I think, which is emerging here, is do I want to approach this as a religious problem, or do I want to approach this as a national problem? Understanding that because of the complexities of Jewish identity, Amech Ami Elokayich Elokai, they're always intertwined. Remember I told you from the very beginning, the intersect between these two things is making this whole thing very, very complicated.
What's your solution?
What's my solution? I'm converting to a different group. Yes.
If we step away from this for a moment and just look at Uvdot Bashetach.
So okay. Facts on the ground.
You read the Pew study that was done recently, and it's all over but the cheering, folks. Meaning, 80% of the Jewish people are intermarrying, and I'm not talking about ones that want to be that want to convert even. It's almost as if the game is over. It's frightening. It's a horrible statistic. It's mind-boggling, and it makes this kind of quibbling. You know, you finally got somebody that wants to join the club. You have to have blinders on not to try to get as many as you can, because in another generation, or at best two, we're done.
But you have to remember, you know, I'm not going to respond to the Pew part, because I don't think sufficiently knowledgeable enough about any of it to respond to that. I'll say two things. Number one, anytime there's a crisis, there's always two possible responses, right? One is to circle the wagons and protect the core. The other is to try to go out there and reverse the trend. That's number one. And we can understand either of them. But the other piece I want you to see is that from Rav Moshe Feinstein and many other Rabbanim's perspective, Orthodox Rabbanim, you're not solving the problem by welcoming in Jews who are not observant. They don't see it as solving the halachic technical problem, Kabbalat mitzvot, that the conversion itself they don't see as valid, and they don't see the net result as positive. So for them, that's not a solution. I understand when you're not in that frame of mind, you look at that and say, how can you say that? An Orthodox Beit Din can convert more people, will solve more problems. From their end, that's not solving a problem. Because the problem is not numbers. The problem is the observance of commandments among the Jewish people. Creating more Jews that don't observe commandments for them is not a solution.
They don't mind driving away more Jews.
Driving away more. Again, it depends what you mean by driving away more Jews. I want to be very gentle with this. Anytime you have standards, you're going to be excluding people. It is the nature of standards. That doesn't mean certain standards can strike us as very unfair and harsh. But at the same time, you know, I'll remind you of this also. There are many Reform conversions that conservative rabbis don't recognize. It is a built-in problem to the denominationalism of Jewish life. It's just normally we can work around it because we're all Jews in the end. When it comes to Jewish status issues, we can't rely on that. Yes? I think it is. It's just not seen as the divisive part. Whereas once upon a time, my sense is that the welcoming body was more concerned about a person's willingness to take on the financial burdens of the community and to suffer the indignities of being Jewish. And they really weren't worried about Shabbat or Kashrut because they'd come to Shul. They know what that's all about, and they didn't see that as the problem. I think maybe today it's flipped. When someone comes to join the Jewish people, especially in Israel, we're not worried they're not going to take on the social national burden. They're serving in the army. They're paying their taxes. They're good citizens. We're now worried about the ritual side of things. It all depends on where we're suspicious or what our concerns are, I think, on some level. Your point is still well taken. We seem to have lost some of those priorities as well. Other questions or comments? So, now that we understand why things are so complicated, right? So it's not only the question of what are the standards. You now also see it's a question of who has the authority, who is the Beit Din that can decide. And what you have here is not simply a capricious political debate between rabbis. You do have that too. But underneath that, you also have, I think, we have to recognize there is serious division among the Jewish people as to what Judaism is and what does it mean to convert to Judaism. I have a little time left, and I want to look at another dimension of this debate that has emerged very strongly as of late, and that is the issue of converting children. I am not talking about capturing random children in Montana and converting them and whisking them off to Israel. That's not okay according to anybody's definition. But we are talking about the process of is there a mechanism to convert minors and what does it look like? And this has come up as of late because many rabbis in the religious Zionist camp are now want to assert this model more aggressively as a way of handling some of this problem of the growing Israeli sort of Jewish, non-Jewish population. I should say, before I ask you to look at this text for a few minutes, is there, as of late, the story's gotten more complicated because a group of Zionist rabbanim have now formed their own network of conversion courts and are now converting people outside of the Rabbanut framework. And some of them are quite famous and well-known, like Rav Stav or Rav Riskin, or Rav Rabinovich from Male Adumim. In other words, we're not talking about C. Hirschfield, Levi Cooper, and Daniel Shibley making a Beit Din. Well, Levi, I shouldn't include him in that. But C. Hirschfield and Daniel Shibley and one other person making a Beit Din. We're talking about leaders and Talmidei Chachamim in the modern Zionist camp. So things are happening. There is an awareness that the approach to conversion has to change. The only thing I want to caution is it's not a blanket solution for everybody. But let's take a look now at this issue of converting children, just as another example of what might be going on. Take a little time. Take a look at this text. It's not an easy text, but if you can just glean the basics from it, we'll talk about it.
Just
source 10. We're not going to go into the details too deeply, but if you're a halachist, as many of you I know are, and you're looking to solve the problem of conversion in Israel, this text would seem to be a gold mine. Why? What does the Mishnah lay out the possibility of? Converting a child. How is that possible? Doesn't conversion require a voluntary acceptance? Or isn't that the text that we saw? The person comes to the Beit Din, you guys are a good Beit Din, or the authorities, and says, I want to join, and you give me all this information, and I have to understand and think about it and accept. We're talking about a two-year-old, an infant, a three-year-old. How is this working? What happened? Well, so here's the question of how this is working. But if you take a look, Rav Huna, an Amora, explains it. He says a minor proselyte is immersed by the direction of the court. The Beit Din can act to convert the minor, it seems, without requiring, you don't have to be an adult because the Beit Din can do it on their behalf. And they say, why? Because it's an advantage for him. It's an amazing argument. It's good to be a Jew. How many people here felt that before 20 seconds ago? It's a good question. But here, the Talmud is saying it's a benefit. To go from being not Jewish to Jewish is a benefit. In spite of all the risks and the responsibilities and the difficulties. Well, so I'm glad the rabbis thought that. Can you imagine if they said, ugh, who wants this? Like, no, it's good. We like it. It's good. It's good for us. It's good for them if they want to choose it. It's a benefit to them. And they're employing a very legal argument, which says you can act in somebody's benefit even without their permission or consent. In normative language, that means that if there's a pile of money on the floor, I can pick it up and acquire it on behalf of somebody else without them ever telling me. From the moment I pick it up, it's theirs. Because it's a benefit to them. Here, Rav Huna is saying the same logic applies to conversion. The court can convert minors because it's a benefit to them. So now we would seem to have a fantastic opening to solve our problem. Because our whole problem seemed to have been accepting mitzvot. Is there acceptance of mitzvot on the behalf of a three-year-old?
No.
They can't do it anyways. It's meaningless. Look, it's like finding a delicious fat-free ice cream. We have a conversion. Thank you, Shibley. We have a conversion that seems to sidestep the whole problem of accepting mitzvot. It would seem then we'd be able to convert the minors, the children, without worrying about whether or not they're going to be observant. This seems to be a possibility in this text if you want to go in that direction. There is one little caveat that comes up. The text informs us of a very strange element. If you look down, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines from the bottom, Rav Yosef throws a bit of a wrench into our cool halachic gear. Did that metaphor work out, Josh? Oh, it did. Okay. Rav Yosef said, when they have become of age, they can protest. There's an escape clause. Boy, Mark, you got it right on the head. There's an escape clause. When they come of age, presumably when they enter adulthood, what can they do? They can leave the club. There's like a recognition. We know we did all this without your consent. Here's your chance, in or out.
Why is that a problem?
Well, we're going to see in a minute. But I would say, fundamentally, let's say you convert that kid to in a totally secular family. How do you understand the term protest when they reach adulthood? How do you understand that term? What are my options? If you want to be very legalistic, what does it mean to protest?
It declares, I protest.
Right? It means he runs over the age of 13, pounds on the door of the Beit Din, says, I got 11 hours to tell you I am not in. Thank you very much. It's been a nice run. I choose to be elsewhere. That's one possibility. You actually have to go before Beit Din. What's another possibility?
By your actions.
You protest by saying, by not living that way. by not following the rules.
And a Jew born Jewish, if that's a part of the rule, he's not out.
I know. Isn't that weird? We don't get to opt out if you're born in. I shouldn't say we. Jews who are born in don't get to opt out.
But you're not talking about opting out. You're talking about your behavior. And
so
Jewish behavior can... So that doesn't make sense.
Well, it's the million-dollar question. What does it mean to protest? If you go with a more technical legalistic idea, then to protest means to knock on the door of the Beit Din and say, I hereby inform you I'm done. But if you understand protest to mean, I indicate to you through my actions that the mitzvot are of no interest to me. See, the problem is, for some legal authorities, the missing component of accepting the commandments kicks in when they become an adult. We need some indication that they have bought in. And then the reverse of that is, in the same way doing the commandments might indicate acceptance, does not doing them indicate I'm out? It's a very subtle, difficult legal point. And there are different, I didn't bring them to you, but the medieval commentators debate this very point. If you look at the Shulchan Aruch in Source 11, he says something, he quotes, really quoting Rabbeinu Asher from the 13th century, who says as follows, what is the case we are dealing with here where the minor can protest? It is a case where he never practiced a Jewish act. If he practiced a Jewish act, he can no longer protest. Now, if you're a good legal scholar, what's the first question that went through your mind? What's a Jewish act? A lot of ink spilled on this one also. Does he have to go to shul? Can he give tzedakah? How about an act of chesed? Rav Rabinovich says any act of chesed counts. On his 13th birthday, he helped his mother in the kitchen. Kibud av v'eim. Welcome to Jewish life. Ah, you can also say he never nullified it. Take a look at source number 12. We're building the case. For all those who want to be lenient here, this is the case they're going to build. Minors are in unless they do something drastic to remove themselves. Therefore, there's no risk in converting minors. The Pitchei Tshuva quotes the Chatam Sofer, who says, in response to the Chatam Sofer, he raised the possibility that one who is born a non-Jew who converts along with his father does not have the option of protest. Protest is only if the minor converts on their own. They convert as a family. There's no protesting. Take a look at the last piece. The Bahag, a Gaonic work, much earlier, held that one whom is brought by his parent to convert, even if the parent did not convert with him, also cannot protest. So here you have some Rabbanim today saying there's no risk in converting the minors. A, you don't need Kabbalat Mitzvot, number one. Number two, protest isn't going to be a problem. Because if they convert with their parents' approval, they can't protest. And even if you say they can, the protest would have to be technical. And certainly they're going to do something Jewish. Particularly if they're walking around the state of Israel, that's going to include them as being in. Yes?
I still don't understand what the problem is if an individual protests after coming of age and wants his Jewishness nullified. What's the problem?
The problem would be is if they protest, but they never formally tell anybody they want their Jewishness nullified. In other words, from a certain... Well, from a certain perspective, then, you would have a category of people who are not halachically Jewish, but nobody knows about it. And that would make the certain Rabbanim very, very uncomfortable, meaning that you'd have a whole class of people who came of age, are halachically not Jewish, but it's all hidden. They don't want to create that problem.
That's only a definition of what protest
is. I understand. But let's look at that for a minute. What is the logic of protest? Let's defend the more stringent position just for a moment. What is the logic of protest? Why is it if they protest they can get out?
They did something against my will.
I don't want in. At some point, I have to choose being a Jew if I'm born a non-Jew. I don't choose this. I don't want it. Now remember our definitional terms. If you associate being a Jew with following the mitzvot and following halacha, in effect you could make a halachic case that protest means they don't intend to lead an observant life. And in fact, that is exactly what some rabbanim maintain to this day. Take a look at a response of Moshe Sternbuch, who wrote this response. He was chief rabbi of South Africa, by the way. Take a look at what he says. If we say that the fact that he does not protest upon reaching adulthood acts as his acceptance of the commandments, in this case, he was in with the case of somebody who was like 21 years old, was converted as a child, and led a completely non-observant life. In this case, there was no acceptance of the commandments, and he would not be Jewish even if he did not protest, right? He's saying this guy never did anything to reflect an acceptance of the commandments. Therefore, even without a verbal protest, he's still not in. There is a concern that one who reaches adulthood and does not observe the commandments has nullified his conversion. This is where the music's supposed to go. Dun, dun, dun. Thus, a minor who converts, even if he does not protest upon reaching adulthood, has the status of one who protests by the fact that he did not observe the Torah, and his conversion has been nullified because he never accepted the commandments. Alan Adler is not happy right now, just to inform you. I will also tell you Rav Kook was sympathetic to this position.
Does anybody challenge?
Great question. Well, Rav Sternbuch was telling him now. By the way, well, he predated Rav Sternbuch, but there were many rabbis that were sympathetic to this idea that protest meant they did not intend to live a life according to the commandments. Basically, their view of the system was, it's not that with minors there is no acceptance of the commandments, but rather it's delayed until the age of 13, at which point they have to do something to declare in or out. I want to tell you something. Legally, it's not bad logic. It just creates a very big mess. But even in his own tshuva, look what he says. However, Rav Chaim Ozer, who was the chief rabbi in Vilna until the time of the Shoah, disagreed and said that desecrating the Sabbath in this case would simply be a sin and not a protest, especially for one who observes some of the commandments. Yes? Ah, but luckily for us, the Talmud didn't go in that direction. The Talmud said you can convert a minor. I hear what you're saying.
But either a parent makes, parents make these sorts of decisions on behalf of children that are sometimes irreparable. Either that's a decision that holds good, and a decision is made by an adult on behalf of a child, and why we visit them at 13.
Yeah.
I
hear you. You're saying, boy, this whole thing, you kind of undermine it. By saying on the one hand you can convert him without his consent, but on the other hand he can protest, you seem to be grasping at opposite things at the same time. I hear your point. But for better or for worse, that's what the Talmud gave us. So the question is, how do we work with that? So I think Rav Sternbuch is basically agreeing with you, and he's saying, as the Ritva seems to imply, there's a delay. You can convert him now on the assumption that when he's 13, he will finish the process. But many authorities didn't view it that way. They actually felt that it's a full, complete conversion, mida oraita, on a biblical level. The Ritva, the Ramban, most Rishonim say that. However, he has an escape clause if he chooses to use it. How that would work, and what's bothering Valerie, I understand. Where's my escape clause? I've asked that question too. But at least in principle, that's how they're looking at it. That he's fully in, but there's an escape clause. That's really the debate. But the ramifications of that debate are enormous, because for Rav Sternbuch and others, you can't start tampering with converting minors who won't be observant, because they won't really be Jewish anyways when they reach adulthood. Other rabbanim, like Rav Chaim Ozer, are saying it doesn't work that way. Without a formal protest, without Naomi Michlin sending that 13-year-old to the Beit Din and pounding on the door, they're Jewish, and that's what Rav Rabinovich says. Rav Rabinovich argues it's not possible that on their, by the time they're 13, they won't do some act of chesed that will automatically, as the Shulchan Aruch says, make them Jewish. Now, there's one other point of attack. Is it a schut for them? Are we doing the Gentile a favor if we convert a Gentile child knowing that they will not be observant as adults? To put it crudely, is it better to be a Jew who sins or a Gentile? How's that for the most un-PC question a person could ask in this building? Remember when you mayor asked it.
It depends where you live.
Well, let's find out.
If you live here and you want to get married, then you're basically...
Excellent. Excellent. So let's look. Rav Moshe Feinstein's going to say something I think you might like. He was dealing with the case of kids who were born to either non-Jewish mothers or mothers who converted in liberal movements. We already know what he thinks about those conversions, who are attending an Orthodox day school. What should we do? Look at what he says. What happens in a case where you have a day school founded by Torah observant Jews, but many of the students are children of mothers who were converted by the Reform and Conservative movements, which we know are not valid? Yes, he threw that in. We can address this by converting the children, because they do not need to formally accept the commandments. They can be converted by the authority of the Beit Din because it is a benefit for them. It's better that they be Jewish and not Jewish. Since they are learning in a religious school with Orthodox teachers, it is likely they will grow up to be observant. That's pretty optimistic. Thus, even though there is a risk, it is definitely a benefit for them, he says. Even if they do not grow up to be observant, it still appears to be a benefit for them, because even for the wicked of Israel, the mitzvot they do count as mitzvot, and the sins they commit will be seen as unintentional. It is certainly a benefit for them not to be Gentiles. Completely un-PC, I would not teach this at an ecumenical conference, but the legal principle, at least, is fascinating. Rav Moshe Feinstein is saying you can convert minors because it's better to be Jewish and not be Jewish, even if you're not observant. Yes? In this country, the Rabbanut has not taken that tack. They have not gone in the direction. Right now, you cannot come without the parents in almost... Just so I shouldn't leave you feeling positive, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg took a different tack. He said, in our case, it is not a benefit to him. It's not good to convert a child who won't grow up to be observant, because it is certain he will not keep the commandments when he is older. It is better for him to remain a Gentile and not be obligated in the commandments as a Jew. Where, again, that same debate we alluded to emerges. Do I want to judge this on a purely religious level? In which case, I might say, I don't want to convert Jews who will not be observant Jews, or do I want to take a national, wider perspective and say, it might be better for the Jewish people, especially here in Israel, if they are considered and recognized as Jews. So, this last one, I believe, is also the 1970s, if I'm not mistaken, but I'd have to look it up. 60s, you think? He was not here. He was in Switzerland. Was he already passed away by the 70s, you think? So this debate, I gave you samples. It's an ongoing discussion. It's an ongoing debate. As I've said, the policy of the Rabbanut and the policy of these new Batei Din have diverged on this point. But I would still argue that the foundational debate is happening on a bunch of different levels. Number one, who is authorized to make these decisions? That's one thing that they're clearly arguing about. Who's the authority? Is it the chief rabbinate? Is it any rabbanim who are Talmidei Chachamim and believe they have a voice? Number two, this is a big one. Should conversion always appeal to the strictest standard? So it's most widely recognized. Some rabbanim out there say, listen, even though I would want to be lenient, what benefit have I brought you if I convert you, but then your fellow Jews still don't recognize you? So some people argue better to be stringent so more people will accept your conversion status. The third issue, as I've said, comes down to, what do you want to look at? Do you want to look at mitzvot observance as your foundational criteria? Or do you want to look at sort of a national Jewish peoplehood perspective? Or to borrow, right, really what you were saying, Amech Ami Elokaich Elokai, which one should be determining your thoughts? And maybe our answer here in Israel will be different than the answer that diaspora Jews have to that question. Closing comments or questions? Yes.
How is that alternative Beit Din being viewed here? Accepted, not, do they also do marriages?
Well, they are marrying people. And the big question is, what's the chief rabbinate going to do? Is the chief rabbinate at the end of the day going to just simply accept these people, or are they going to hold their line? I don't know. It's a very good question what's going to happen. You've got now dozens, if not hundreds, of test cases that are now going to be emerging, and what are people going to do? It's a great, great question.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Yeah, it's very exciting. All this crisis and calamity makes for very interesting reading. Other questions or comments that you're... Do you feel a little clearer now about the nature of the debate in Israeli society? We did our job in that regard? Okay. Any other closing questions before we end? So I want to encourage you, whether you live here or there, everybody in this room has a vested interest in this discussion. This is about the Jewish people trying to define ourselves. And it's okay if we think different things, but I don't think any of us can be indifferent to this question. It's affecting more and more of us. It's got national implications, and it's challenging us to define for ourselves what we think are the core elements of what it means to be a Jew today. So nobody can leave here indifferent. You can have strongly divergent opinions, but you got to stay engaged and continue thinking about it and make your voice heard, in my opinion. Anyways, I hope you have a continued awesome seminar.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.